This morning, we are inviting, in this first part of the show, questions about household insect pests. And our guest for the show is Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist from the U of I, and it's his specialty, dealing with these sorts of things. And he's been on this program before many times to try to help out with those kind of problems. If you have a bug problem, can be in the house or can be in the yard, in the home landscape. Could be something that's attacking your trees or your plants, or it could be just something that's bugging you inside. If you call in and tell us about it, he will tell you what to do. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Well, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
I'm sure that we'll get some calls here going in a bit. Maybe one thing that we might talk a little bit, you said that it's time to be thinking about dealing with bagworms if you have them.
Yes.
Let's do that.
And bagworms, if you're not familiar with what they are going to be, when they get full grown, they're spindle-shaped, tapered at both ends, in a bag that's up to about an inch and a half long. And they cover the outside of this, it's really a silk bag that they cover the outside of with their clippings from a plant that they're feeding on. And they will start at the top of a tree and work their way down, and they feed on a variety of trees and shrubs. Primarily, we see them feeding on arborvitae and spruce. They'll feed on white pine, eastern red cedar, other junipers. They'll feed on deciduous trees too, such as crab apples and oaks and so on. But really where they do their damage are in the evergreen, needled evergreens, because if they strip a branch, commonly that branch will die. And so it becomes important. The eggs hatch out in early to mid-June, and they will blow from tree to tree as young larvae for about 2 weeks before they settle down to feed. And they have settled down now to feed, and so now is the time to treat your bagworms. And we recommend treatment of using Bacillus thuringiensis kerstockii, which is sold, called BTK many times, sold as Dipel or Thuricide and other brand names. There are also other pyrethroid insecticides that are effective, but usually we recommend for homeowners the BTK, and it works quite well. If you need to be able to hit to the top of a tree with a sprayer in order to do the job, and if your tree is too tall for that, you need to hire it done, because they start at the top, and you can lose the top of a tree, which greatly reduces the appeal of the rest of a tree. So you got to make sure that you can reach the top of a tree, and if not, you may need to have it hired done. But these are serious pests and will kill trees.
Okay. We have a caller here. Let's try here for line number two in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. For some reason, I hear music.
Yes, and we're hearing it too, and we really don't know what it's about. I tell you what, if you can put up with that, go ahead and ask your question, and then maybe
Sorry,
Phil can...
I can't hear you. I'll call you back.
All right. Well, my apologies, folks. We're not quite sure what's going on here this morning. Our operator, Henry Frain, is tearing his hair out in there trying to figure out what's going on. If we can do that, we will take calls, as always. And if not, I think we can continue to chat here with Phil. Well, one of the things that we said we could talk about was the grubs in lawn. And I'm sure that people maybe are itching to do something about it or wondering about it. I think in the past, probably one of the things that we've talked about is the fact that people tend to want to get on that too soon. And they're too eager to do it. And there is a particular window that you want to do it, so you can get it at the right time, right?
That's correct. And what happens is that this is the time of year in which the beetles are flying that are actually going to be laying the eggs that will produce the white grubs later in the year that can cause damage to your lawn. There's three species. One is a Japanese beetle, which many people are seeing around feeding on their trees and shrubs right now. And they will be laying eggs in the turf, as well as the annual white grubs or mast chafers. They're two species, and they look somewhat similar. They're both about a half an inch long and tan in color, June beetle-like insects that will fly to lights at night. And they've been coming out and are getting numerous. They're not too heavy yet, but they are laying their eggs in the soil, as well as the half-inch June beetle, as half-inch Japanese beetles, which are metallic green with coppery wing covers. And they will lay their eggs primarily during the first couple weeks of the month of July. And depending on how the weather holds, will have a lot to do with whether we're going to have a problem with those. The insects very much like irrigated turf, green grass, in order to lay their eggs into, and they will go to those areas. If our weather pattern holds in much of Illinois, where we've got plenty of rainfall and grass is nice and green and the soil is moist regardless of whether it's irrigated or not, as it is right now in east central Illinois, the boaf beetles will lay their eggs over large expanses of areas, and we really won't have probably any real damage anywhere because the beetles will be spread out and the grubs will be spread out. But if it turns off dry and hot, like it typically does in the first half of July, and the non-irrigated turf gets that brownish look, what horticulturists call dormant and what homeowners commonly call dead, it's not really dead. It will green back up without putting water on it as it rains more in the fall, in late summer. In those situations, they will flock to the irrigated turf, and they will lay their eggs there, and so the people that water their lawns will have them. And this is the month, any time this month, is when you would apply one of two chemicals that we look at preventing them in irrigated turf, and that one of those is imidacloprid, which is sold as Merit, and you'll find it as Merit in garden centers. The other one is halofenazide, which is sold as Mach 2 commercially, but you'll see that as Grub X in your home garden center and things of that nature, home center, and that material can be applied. Anytime during July, it will take about 3 weeks to kill the grubs, but they'll be dead by the time you start to see any real damage in the lawn in the latter half of August through September and October. The insects will feed on the roots of the grass and cause the tops to brown out, loosens up, and you can just pull the turf back and the grubs will be right there. They're C-shaped and white up to an inch long. If you don't treat now and you feel like you might get away with it, you can always check the turf in the early part of August, cut through the turf, pull it back. And if you do have grubs at that point, then there's a third compound called triclorfan, sold as Dilox, D-Y-L-O-X. And that's applied only when the grubs are present. It will kill the grubs in 3 days and give you good control.
Okay. I know the beetles are out there. I've seen them in my yard. They've maybe been around for at least a week, probably. Maybe
close to that,
more.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And it's now the 6th of July. How much longer are the adult insects that are out there now Japanese beetles, how much longer are they going to be around?
They're out for about 6 weeks, and so we'll have them in fairly high numbers. I mean, you can find a long-lived didn't get eaten by anything else Japanese beetle into early October or even later, but numbers enough, high enough to do any real serious damage or any problems about the middle of August. And they will attack, they'll start feeding on the tops of trees, primarily are going to attack crab apples, lindens, birches, willows. They like grapes. They really love roses. They eat smartweed, for one thing, as well. And it can be controlled on plants that you're concerned about with insecticide sprays. We recommend either Carbaryl, which is sold as 7, or Cyflufrin, which is sold as Bayer Advanced Garden Multi-Insect Killer. And this material will give about, either of these will give about 2 weeks of control. So you do the math, you're doing about 3 sprays. We recommend that people only treat those trees and shrubs that are really important in a landscape, that they look nice, like ones next to the front door, ones that people walk by on the sidewalk and notice a lot. Large plants that you may not be able to treat very well, or those that are kind of in the backyard that are mainly used to hide the garbage can or be up against a fence or something, just let them go. Damage at this time of year by any insect is not very severe. On a deciduous tree, a tree that normally drops its leaves. So the damage by the Japanese beetles at this time of year is not a real serious health problem to the tree. It may slow their growth some, but it's primarily an aesthetic thing, and to reduce the amount of insecticide used, reduce the cost if you're having it sprayed, only treat those trees that are really very important and the damage is very obvious in your landscape.
Okay. Well, we're going to try again here with a caller. We have somebody ready to go to line 1 in Urbana. Let's go there. Hello.
good morning. This time it seems that I have better luck.
Great. Well,
music.
Whatever the problem was, I guess we got it taken care of. So please go ahead.
Great. Actually, I think part of my question was answered, and that was going to be about Japanese beetles. They're horrible this year, in my yard at least. And I have all of the trees that you listed, and they're on all of them. And
I always like to say, if you plant it, they will come.
Yes.
If you plant the right trees, they will come.
Absolutely. And it seems like it's a lost cause, although I hate to see just skeletons of trees remaining, and there's going to be going on war.
Typically, for your larger trees, they'll eat the top third to a half of the leaves on a tree and leave the bottom half to two-thirds of the leaves, so from the canopy up. So generally, you're not going to lose all the leaves, but you do lose a large number of them.
Well, I wish that were the case in my yard, because last year they just about ate all of the linden. There was nothing left of it, and this is a huge tree. I don't know, maybe it was a tasty variety that they really like. And I noticed that they're even going on white pines. It's like you spray one tree, and they just go and attach themselves to the nearest tree.
They will feed on white pines, although usually not very heavily.
Wow, that's not good news.
Okay. And, of course, if they strip branches on white pines, those branches may die. So you've got to be very watchful about heavy feeding damage on a needled evergreen.
So, actually, I could go ahead and spray the white pines, too, because
yes.
They're more important.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're more at a threat of having serious injury than the linden and other trees in your yard.
Well, given that I have about 20 of those, I think the rest of my summer is going to be spent spraying them.
Well, it's only every 2 weeks, but still, it's probably 3 sprays. So.
Right. Now, my other question is about termites. And mm-hmm. How do you know if you have or don't have termites? Is there a way to check for them in, say, I have a 10-year-old house? What do I do? What is it that I need to inspect? Or should I have a professional come look at it?
Well, it doesn't hurt to have a professional come in every 3 years or so, maybe even more often than that, if you've got a concern about them that's stronger. But what you look for are areas that where you've got mud tunnels going up across across the foundation on either side, the inside or outside of a foundation, inside of a basement wall or inside of a crawl space. Wall, and these will be look like they're made out of mud, and they'll be about as big around as a lead pencil, maybe as big around as a finger, and they will go up from the soil to the wood of the house, and that's a clear sign that you may have termites in them. If you break those tubes open, active ones will have little eighth-inch long white insects that will show up, and the tunnel will be repaired within a couple of days as well, usually even less than that. So that's always a clear sign that you've got termites. Now, inside the house, they'll tend to go to the hardwoods, and so they're more apt to be around baseboards, the sill plate on the house, which is the board that lays on top of the foundation, and also moldings around doors and windows. These can be tapped with a screwdriver or something. If they sound hollow or if the tip of a screwdriver goes through the wood, you know you've got a problem. And because they will leave just the outside surface of the wood or sometimes even just the paint behind. They will also go up and they will eat the cardboard coating on drywall. And so what you'll see are thin lines going up the side of your inside walls if they're drywall. Where the termites have eaten the cardboard on the surface of drywall, left the paint intact, and the moisture there will cause the paint to bubble or to discolor. And there's a high humidity inside termite colonies. These are all signs that you may have termites, or if you get the winged termites, which are going to be typically a quarter to 3/8 of an inch long, and going to be long wings sticking way out behind an insect which is very dark brown to black in color, and they will come out in large numbers at once with these very glistening, light-reflecting wings.
Apart from keeping an eye open, so to speak, and have a professional look at it every 3 or 4 years, there's no preventative measure to take.
Well, there's a lot of things that are done to houses that are already preventative. Termites like high moisture level. You want to make sure there's good drainage around your house. It's one of the main reasons why houses tend to be have fill around them to help them drain moisture away from a house, along with wood rot. You want to make sure that you don't do something to mess up the building code that prevents termites and wood rot from occurring, and that is having at least a foot to 18 inches of foundation showing around your house, particularly in the Champaign-Urbana area. I see a lot of houses in which people have decided, I don't like to look at that foundation. Let's build siding all the way down to the ground. That's just asking for termites. You don't want to have any piles of firewood right against the house to where they're touching the house. That provides a bridge to termites getting in. Any type of moist conditions that you've got in your house, particularly along the edge now next to the foundation, you want to take care of any water leaks, things of that nature. Moisture will bring them in. These are all things that are done. In fact, many of the things that are built into your house are there because of termites and also wood rot. So a lot of times we just try to avoid messing up what's already been given us in the way of protection and prevention against termites.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Phil Nixon, extension entomologist from U of I. And we're talking about insect pests around the home. If you have a problem, give us a call, and Phil will see if he can help you out. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And next we will talk with someone in Aurora, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I suddenly seem to have spiders in my shower. What can I do to have them not think that's the great place to be?
Well, the first step is that if you haven't had spiders there before and you've been there for quite a while, there may be some sort of moisture situation that's increasing the attractiveness of the area. Spiders are going to go where the prey is, where the food is, where the little insects are and related things. And most of those will feed in a house on molds and mildews associated with moisture. And particularly near a shower stall, you may have a leak around that stall or something like that. You want to check to make sure that you don't have a crack low on the shower somewhere or any indication of moisture, discolored wood, damp wood around that shower or in the bathroom. Otherwise, if you can get underneath that floor in the basement or something like that, look to see if you've got any darkness of a wood in discoloration or moisture there. Those would be all clues that you've got a water leak, which is producing mold, which is producing bugs, which is bringing the spiders. Other than that, an aerosol ant and roach spray around in cracks and crevices will help reduce the number of spiders. Reducing the humidity generally in the bathroom may also help. If you don't already do so, leaving the bathroom door standing open between uses will help reduce the humidity in there. Again, reduces the molds and mildews, reduces the bugs, reduces the spiders indirectly.
What a spider is there that might be in the home would be dangerous to dispose of.
Well, the most common spider that's likely to show up inside a house in Illinois that could be dangerous would be the brown recluse spider. Occasionally we see black widows, but they're a very uncommon thing inside houses. They're more apt to be in an outhouse or around a park or something like this, or in a woodchuck hole. But the brown recluse spider is a nocturnal roaming spider, and it's brown in color, has fairly long spindly legs, not tremendously so. And the leg span is typically about an inch, and the body size is typically only about a quarter of an inch, 3/16, something like that. It will have no markings on it on a brown body except for a dark violin shape on the back, in the middle of the back. And this can be difficult to tell for sure that's what you're looking at. Most spiders have some sort of markings there. But if you've got internet access, you can go and see a photo of a brown recluse and compare it to a spider you might see.
Thank you.
This is Focus 580 here on AM 580 WILL Urbana. My name is David Inge, the host for the show. Glad to have you with us this morning. And we have also as our guest in this first hour, U of I extension entomologist Phil Nixon. And if you have questions about insect problems around the home, you can give us a call. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. The next caller in line is in Chicago, and line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I hear this mosquito magnet advertised a lot. How does that work?
What happens with... Yeah, the mosquito magnet uses propane as a source to produce carbon dioxide, which will... carbon dioxide is one of the chemicals that mosquitoes use to find their hosts to bite, people or birds or other mammals. And the mosquito magnet with limited testing has been shown to be very effective. Most of the devices that are reported to control mosquitoes really don't. Some of the sound-emitting things and light things and so on. But the mosquito magnet and devices similar to it appear to be effective.
Does that have a little pressure tank in there?
Actually, what you have is a propane tank that you have to replace or refill periodically in order to have a supply of CO2 that's being put out by the unit.
I see. Well, I've got an old-time, the device with the light in it and the fan. Now, if I put a piece of dry ice up there, that's carbon dioxide, right?
That's right.
We'll do the same thing?
That's right.
I'll give it a try. Thank
you. If you can find the dry ice. It's not very available. And the light material, the lights have been shown repeatedly, bug zapper type things, have been shown repeatedly to actually increase the number of mosquito bites you're going to get. Because what it will do is it will attract the mosquitoes from a distance, but the mosquitoes that come all the way to the light are males, which don't bite, or females who have laid all their eggs and are no longer biting. Females that are looking for a blood meal will be attracted to your yard by the light, and then they start looking for a warm-blooded host. So it's been shown over and over again that these actually increase the number of bites you'll get in your yard.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Sorry to burst your bubble.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you another mosquito question. It has an off-the-air question that from someone who was interested in knowing what would be the safest outdoor backyard spray for controlling mosquitoes. They have kids and they have dogs, and they're particularly concerned about the possibility of West Nile virus.
Well, what we normally will recommend is rather than spraying a lot of areas repeatedly, we recommend, watching when you're out and avoiding evening activities where the mosquitoes that carry West Nile are going to be more active, and then to wear light-colored clothing that will cover the arms and the legs, and then use an insect repellent containing DEET, such as Cutters or Off, or the soybean canola oil mosquito repellent called Bite Blocker. These have been shown to be effective applied to the skin or the clothing in the case of DEET to help reduce the amount of mosquitoes and mosquito bites. Along with the West Nile virus, we recommend, because the house mosquito, which carries West Nile virus as a primary vector, is not a very far flyer and likes putrid water, we recommend making sure that you and your neighbors clean out, make sure those gutters are cleaned, make sure wading pools and bird baths are dumped and dumped and dried out once a week to kill any mosquito larvae. Same with pet water bowls, old tires, tin cans. This is where the mosquitoes that carry West Nile virus are coming from. They're normally coming from in your own neighborhood, and doing that is the main thing. Only on an occasional outdoor function sort of thing, like you're having a once-a-summer party or something that's going to be in the evening, do we recommend any spraying for mosquitoes in an area. And there we recommend either malathion or some of the pyrethrin materials, which are sold for as mosquito foggers. These can be sprayed into shrubs and trees, underbrush, this sort of area, and will give several hours of control. But to go out there and blitz your yard every day or every other day or even twice a week just to reduce mosquitoes and in the process upset the ecology of your backyard is not recommended by the Extension Service. Mm.
This I'd been wondering about, because I guess I have occasionally used these kind of foggers for if I knew that I was going to be outside in those peak times, and have wondered exactly how the product, first of all, has a very strong sort of floral scent, at least the thing that I've been using. And so I'm wondering, well, is this actually, does it have insecticide in it, or is the idea that it's supposed to throw the mosquitoes off, make it harder for them to find where you are?
Well, the floral scent is primarily something that makes it easier for you to put up with the material.
Okay.
The repellents, particularly DEET, we do know is a product that literally blocks the receptors of a mosquito. So they can't smell us, so to speak. They can't pick up our carbon dioxide, can't pick up our lactic acid that they use to zero in for the bite. So it's actually a sensory blocker on our part that we're using in repellents typically.
All right. Well, let's go again to next caller, Philo, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have evergreen trees. Bagworms are about quarter inch long. I sprayed them with Dipel about 4 or 5 days ago. It has since rained. Do I have to do it again?
As long as that Dipel sat there for preferably at least 2 hours and preferably 4 hours, it would have gotten it would be tight enough to the foliage. It should not wash off. And in fact, with it being 4 days, I dare say that if you went out there and started squeezing bagworms, you'd probably find that most of them are dead by now.
Oh, you're saying everything I want to hear. Lastly, I have, just in case, I ran out of Dipel, and I got another product. They didn't have any. The active ingredient is Spinosad.
Spinosin.
Yes.
Spinosad, it's sold commercially as Conserve. It's also on the homeowner market. That material is gangbusters against bagworms. That was a great product to use. It's a little more toxic than the BTK, but not tremendously so. That's a good option.
Okay. Lastly, should I spray these trees every so often?
One should have done it if you did it 4 days ago, because you want to scout the situation and see the bagworms that are killed do not fall off a tree, but active bagworms will have green foliage at the top of the bag, and if after a week or so you start to see quite a few of them with green foliage top of the bag, you know you didn't get them all, and then a retreatment is necessary. But if you got good coverage first time, you should not have to treat again until at least this time next year.
Oh, this is great. Thanks for the good news.
You're welcome.
Right. Bye.
We have some other callers here on our toll-free line in Equality, Illinois. Do I have that right? Equality, line four?
Wood bees, or bees that burrow into the wood. Do they go through the wood?
What they'll do is they'll go partway into the board, and then they turn, make a right angle and go up the length of a board, sometimes as much as 2 or 3 feet. Wood bees, also known as carpenter bees, will look like bumblebees. They'll be rotund bees. When some species are about an inch across, some are only about a half an inch or a quarter of an inch across, and they'll make a series of cells. What we recommend, particularly this late in the season, is that probably the damage has already been done and the cells have already been produced. We recommend not doing anything now. Let the bees come out, the young ones, and then sometime during the winter or late fall, caulk up the hole, and usually they attack unpainted surfaces, so painting the wood or putting a varnish on it that will stand the outside elements will usually prevent the bees coming in the spring of the year. If they are going in, we recommend 7-Dust, carbaryl soda 7, the dust form around the opening, which will kill the queen bee that's going in and making the cells. But this late in the season, they should be pretty well done. And what we get sometimes is people caulk up a hole, and then all 10 or 12 bees make their own hole to the outside, so instead of going out to mother's hole. And so now instead of one hole, you have a dozen holes up your board. So you're ahead to leave that hole open this time of year and caulk it in the winter and then finish the wood.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. How do you tell the difference between a carpenter bee and a bumblebee?
A bumblebee, the easiest way to tell, and the way I normally tell in the field, is that bumblebees will have some yellow on their abdomen, yellow hairs on their abdomen. Sometimes it's just at the very base of the abdomen, but they will have some yellow. Carpenter bees typically do not have any yellow hairs on their abdomen. If you really want to get friendly with a bee, bumblebees have large eyes carpenter bees have small eyes, and so a bumblebee eyes will almost meet at the top of the head. The carpenter bee eyes are only maybe covered only, say, a third of the head or something like that. So if you really want to get friendly with a bee, you can find it out that way. But the easy way is to look for yellow hairs on the abdomen.
All right. We'll come back here to some local folks. Next in line is Urbana and line number two. Hello.
Hi. The other way to tell is if they're attacking your house.
Well, that's the other way that you can do that, or if they're going in the ground. Bumblebees nest underground, and so they'll use an old rodent burrow or something, so they'll be going down into the soil rather than into the wood.
And I've caught them when I've noticed sawdust floating in the air or what looks kind of like pollen dropping on stuff, accumulating under the holes.
Okay. Well, the bumblebees and the carpenter bees and the honeybees all feed their young on the same thing, and all the other bees, essentially, true bees, will collect pollen. They may have a little nectar in it, depending on the species, and they provision cells by packing them full of pollen. Then they lay an egg on it, and then they typically use a piece of leaf or mud, depending on the species of bee, as a partition, fill another cell full of pollen, lay an egg, and do this sequentially down the hole in the case of carpenter bees. The larva hatches out, feeds on the pollen. The female is no longer present at that time. Grows up. It's a legless, grub-like larva. Pupates and then comes out in the latter part of the summer as an adult bee Interestingly enough, they all tend to come out the same hole, which is always interesting to me because the one deepest down in the wood has to be, the egg was laid earlier, days earlier, and still they tend to come out all together.
So when can we start plugging the holes and painting them? You got to be able to paint.
Yeah, we recommend plugging the holes or painting them in late fall. They typically, the carpenter bees will come out usually by latter part of August through September, sometime of that nature. So so caulking up anywhere, say, in late September through the wintertime, and then painting should work. And you'll have some days there where you can do that.
My other question is about those, since we've been talking about mosquitoes, those coils, those spirals that you light up, are those dangerous to use?
It's not thought to be so. Most of those coils produce citronella, and they're really no more dangerous than a citronella candle. Some of them will produce, will fume out some other types of low toxicity insecticides to people. You want to follow label directions. You obviously wouldn't use those in a confined space. In the first place, mosquitoes aren't going to come into a confined space, typically. They're not going to have a way to get in. So, following label directions, they're safe to use. This is a EPA registered product. They would have had to show all sorts of safety testing in order to get that labeled and okayed for sale in the first place.
The other thing I do, and I've mentioned this before, is I get some big fans out when we have gatherings on our deck at this time of year.
Yeah, that's commonly what I will recommend because most mosquitoes are weak flyers. They can't handle even a 5 or 6 mile an hour breeze, and a window fan will put out that much of a breeze easily, and this will blow them off course to where they really can't land and bite. That's a good way. I recommend that commonly.
And thinking about fogging, I think about an image that I have of I just saw, I was in the woods working on clearing garlic mustard, and I see some amazing things sometimes when I'm in the woods. And there was a hummingbird. I saw it because I heard the wings, and it seemed, there were no flowers around. It seemed to be picking up insects from branches and even raiding spider nests, spider webs for insects. And that's, I think those birds appear so fragile, and I can't imagine that they wouldn't be affected by poisons that might affect certain insects.
Well, generally, the insecticides that be used, particularly the foggers that would be used associated with mosquitoes, the rate is very small, and typically they're not going to be a major factor even on something like a hummingbird. Of course, if you get into hummingbirds, you'll find out that hummingbirds do feed on insects to a great extent. It's not all just nectar. And particularly, if my memory serves me right, is a major food source for nestlings as well. So yeah, they will feed on insects, And trying to avoid the fogging, even a commercial company is checking the level of mosquitoes and fogging only on an intermittent basis. They're not, even though it seems like they're fogging every week, they certainly are not doing so. So it's a, that's an occasional situation, probably is not a huge impact on the environment, but a continuous thing would be. And that's what I was trying to caution a previous caller about.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Let's continue. Next is Urbana. And that would be, no, pardon me, it would be Champagne, line number three. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I want to continue on your discussion about termites and ask a few more questions.
Sure.
You were saying that insects with wings are indications of termites. Now, I've seen some insects like ants with wings. Are those termites?
Well, you got to realize that ants also produce ants with wings, and by far the more common thing is that a winged ant will look like a winged ant from a point of view, meaning that if you look close to body, it will have a hourglass-type waist. It'll be have a very thin waist between the thorax and the abdomen, and termites don't have that. Also, typically, a winged ant will have a body extending just essentially to the end of the wings. It's a very long body in relationship to the wings and pretty well fills the space under the wings. Termites are very, very short insects with wings trailing maybe three times as long as the body length past the body itself. So there's a tremendous difference there.
Okay.
And then if you really want to get close, usually winged ants have elbowed antennae. Termites do not. The two pairs of wings are different size in ants. The second pair of wings will be a quarter of the size or so of the first pair, whereas in termites, all four wings, both pairs are about the same size and shape. And then typically termites emerge in late winter, early spring, and ants will emerge throughout the season. So, but I usually, 90% of the calls I get on somebody wanting to know whether they have a termite or an ant, I'm able to do it over the phone by the person looking, and if they've got that thin waist and the body goes as long as the wings, it's an ant. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Let me ask another question. You said about termites that that the foundation is supposed to be several inches below the house before it reaches the ground, right?
Correct. Uh-huh. You're supposed to have exposed foundation.
Now, the other side of that is I've heard from another speaker on the radio, when we get our Hank Spies program, he always talks about grading away from the house so that you should have your grading not exposing. I'm not sure if he says not exposing.
I doubt that he's saying that. What he's probably referring to, and I would concur completely, is that you want to grade away from a house so you get good drainage away from a house so you don't get moisture against the house. That will attract termites and wood rot, as well as water in your basement.
Right.
So, but you don't want to, in the process of grading, your best way to grade is to reduce the soil back away from the house and not make a grade by piling it against the soil against the house.
Okay.
I've been out with him looking at some termite things in the past, and he's a strong proponent of that soil wood gap that I talked about. So I know we're on the same side here.
Okay, thank you very
much.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I. Every once in a while he's here on the program. We try to help with insect pest problems around the home. So if it's something that's in the house or in the home landscape, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have someone up next in Danvers, and that is line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling about an infestation I have in my home, and we've never seen these bugs before. They're a little less than an inch long. It's skinny, like a small worm. It has legs like a tiny centipede. When you touch them, they roll up.
Okay, this would be a millipede. There should be hard-shelled and kind of brownish, dark brown to black in color. And the millipedes are slow-moving, Typically, you see them as a coil and dead on the floor because they lose moisture very quickly through their bodies. And if they get into the house, typically they die within hours. Even in a fairly moist basement, they will commonly be dead. These are relatives of insects, and as such, the insects that we have, the insecticides we have, are not very good at preventing them or keeping them out of the house. We recommend that you reduce the growing, the conditions that they like to survive in, and that means reducing dead organic matter. That would mean fallen leaves or bark mulches next to the house. And then reduce the moisture. Make sure that plantings are not so thick that they're able to dry out in between rains within just a couple 3 days. So you don't have a constantly moist soil next to the house or other material. Caulking cracks and crevices in the foundation will also help keep them out. Outdoors, they're part of nature, and you usually don't need to worry about them. But we really don't have any insecticides that will work very well against millipedes. They're related to insects, but too distantly for insecticides to be very effective.
Well, I was surprised that they're crawling like across the living room floor, which is like a really dry area, and they seem to move faster than any millipedes I've seen. So just like try to destroy the ones that are in the moist area.
Well, if you've got fast-moving ones, then you may have centipedes, which are normally going to move quite quickly. You know, where a millipede might take 30 seconds to move 2 inches, a centipede's going to do that in a couple seconds. So they're a much faster moving creature, and they are more easily controlled with an aerosol ant and roach spray in cracks and crevices. They are predators. They will feed on insects and other small creatures. So you may have a situation, if there's a lot of them, you may have a situation where you've got some moisture or something that's generating mold, which is, again, feeding the bugs, which is feeding these. But an occasional one is probably just coming in from the outside. Reducing the moisture and organic matter next to the house will also reduce these. But these are going to be more easily controlled with a ant and roach spray in cracks and crevices, baseboards, this sort of thing.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. All right, thank you. Let's go next to Kankakee County in our line number 4. Hello.
Just answered part of the question, exactly the same thing. These things are about an inch long and have a antenna on the front about, another inch, eighth of an inch long.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how you get rid of these things other than using the Chinese method of grabbing them and flushing them.
I never heard that was a Chinese method. But at any rate, you're talking about real slow-moving, curly...
Yeah, if
you the millipedes.
Touch them, they make a C.
Yeah. Again, the millipedes need dead organic matter and moisture. And if you can remove either or both, you greatly reduce the number of millipedes. Reducing the amount of dead organic matter next to the outside foundation and the moisture, reducing moisture there will greatly reduce the number of millipedes that come in. Now, in some areas of the state, and particularly in the Chicago metropolitan area where you're looking at perch water tables over clay, you can have situations where you can do everything you can and the moisture level stays too high and you continue to have millipedes come in. And I get calls from up there about them crawling up off sides of the houses on foggy mornings and getting up to the second floor windows, this sort of thing. Literally thousands of them on the side of a house and all over the driveway and everything else. And there's very little you can do about that because you can't control the moisture in some of these housing developments.
You can't control it in a forest either.
In a forest, it's hard where you've got is the moisture and you've got the organic matter. And if you've got a house in the middle of a forest and you want to have a forest come right up to your house, you're going to have to put up with the millipedes in exchange for having the nice forest to look at.
Yeah, this is the first time in 10 years I've ever had them in the house. I've had them in the basement, but this is the first time they ever come up.
Caulking cracks and crevices around foundations will help. Running a dehumidifier in the basement may take care of them there to where they don't come up in the house so much.
Mm-hmm. But the ant and roach spray does...
Does very little control. We normally figure that an ant and roach spray, they come across that residue, it's going to kill maybe 1 in 5, which from our way of looking things, you just will not even bother.
Right. Go back to catching them and flushing them.
Yeah, that'll work. Or, again, if you have a house, if you have humidity down in the house, typically what you'll find is the curled dead bodies, which you just have to sweep up.
Right.
That's usually a better option than having them alive, at least.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Bye. And next to Bourbon A, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning. I have a unusual problem. My son got two Madagascar hissing cockroaches about 6 years. Well, excuse me, 6 months ago. We put them in a container that we thought would contain the babies. Unfortunately, not. kind of unusual, but probably within the last week, excuse me, last 3 weeks, they've been hatching babies. And we put the cockroaches outside, then we went through his room and physically removed all that we could. I put some roach traps out. I also was planning to fog the room with a commercial fogger. My main concern is, do these type of animals, do they have the capacity to infest the house like, you know, normal household cockroaches?
Probably not in this climate. If you were living in Florida, perhaps.
Okay.
But the Madagascar hissing roach is a forest species. It needs a very high humidity in order to survive. And it's probably not, the young were probably not going to survive. Rather than using a fogger, I would suggest an aerosol ant and roach spray in cracks and crevices. That's going to get them where they live and do a much better job than a fogger will do.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I wouldn't bother with a fogger. I'd use an aerosol ant and roach instead. And then you know, once it's been several days, you know, you can probably move the adults back in under in a better cage and,
right.
and be in good shape. This roach usually does not reproduce very heavily, so and it has a very long lifespan. So it's a but I doubt so they typically aren't going to flood you with babies. And normally I would be suspicious of them surviving. I do know in certain parts of the world they can be a household insect, but we're normally talking about the Caribbean, not North America, where you have more humidity and so on.
Okay, thank you. That is
all
good
right.
to hear.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you.
We'll try to get real quick one more. Homer, line three. Hello.
Yeah, it's about every year this time I get these big, I guess I call them wood bees. They're kind of orangey in color. Come out of the ground. Are they anything to worry about, and do they sting?
Okay, these are elongate insects, right? About an inch and a half long?
Yeah, they're big.
Okay. These are probably cicada killers, and they'll have reddish, clear reddish wings, and they will actually, they're more interested in the cicadas that you hear at night, the dog day or annual cicadas. They are very reluctant to sting. The ones that will fly around and bug you are males. They can't sting. The ones burrowing into the ground will be females, and you've pretty well got to step on one barefoot or grab a hold of one barehanded to be stung. They can sting, very reluctant to do so. We recommend coexistence. If there's a problem with them in a location where they are, some 7 dust around the opening will get rid of an individual, but we normally recommend live and let live.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. This is a wasp, and
it's actually
the
a type
biggest
of wasp.
Wasp you're ever going to see.
Yeah, and this is the time when they first start showing up. Typically, they're around through most July.
Okay, well, there we would leave it this time around. We had somebody who wanted to know when was Phil going to be on again.
That's up to WILL.
That's up to us. Well, I'm thinking maybe at least one more time. Maybe in August, about a month. You think
glad to be here
do it
again. Yeah.
All right, and in the meantime, look in your phone book, and your local extension person, whoever's close to you, can help with this kind of question. And, of course, then if they can't answer the question, then Phil is the guy that gets the question.
It'll be under University of Illinois Extension or underneath your county name and then University of Illinois Extension under that.
Well, thank you very much. Phil Nixon, he's extension entomologist with U of I.